from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. It's gotten attention all across the country, the tragic story of 13-year-old Jahi McMath, who suffered brain death 2 weeks ago following surgery at Oakland's Children's Hospital. Her family has resisted taking her off a ventilator, despite the judgment of numerous physicians, including one appointed by the court to conduct an independent review. In our next hour forum, we explore the questions raised by the Jahi McMath story. How do we define death? What are the consequences for accepting or resisting that definition? And what can be done to help families when tragedy strikes? That discussion ahead on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. A little over 2 weeks ago, 13-year-old Jahi McMath was declared brain dead following surgery at Oakland's Children's Hospital. Despite the judgment of numerous doctors, her family has sought desperately to keep her on a respirator, which is all that allows her heart to continue to beat. The court has ruled that the hospital may discontinue that artificial breathing apparatus at 5 o'clock today. It's a tragic story that puts in the spotlight our definition and understanding of death and the consequences of both for families as well as for society as a whole. And we want to have that conversation today. Joining us, David Magnus. He's the director for the Center for Biomedical Ethics and Thomas Raffin Professor of Medicine, Biomedical Ethics, and also a professor of pediatrics at Stanford University. David Magnus, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us, too, is Chris Tate. She's the director of bereavement services for Pathways Home Health and Hospice here in the Bay Area. Chris Tate, good morning.
Good morning to you.
And David Greer joins us as well, professor of neurology and neurosurgery at the Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Greer, thanks for being part of our program.
Thanks for having me.
So let's briefly review where things stand right now, David Magnus, with the Jahi McMath story. She was declared brain dead on December the 12th. There's been lots of back and forth in the courts about this. There was a court-appointed physician from Stanford who reviewed the situation, came to the same conclusion. How is it best to understand what is happening now? The family continues to hope that perhaps someplace else might take Jahi. What is the best way to understand Jahi's current circumstance?
So sadly, tragically, Jahi passed away and passed away some time ago. Dr. Greer can comment in more detail about the neurological criteria for determination of death, but six separate independent evaluations have all found that she sadly passed away. So she is medically dead. She's legally dead in accordance with the laws of California and, in fact, virtually every other state. So sadly, Jahi has passed away and is no longer with us. What we have right now is a body that is being ventilated so that there's still oxygen, oxygenating organs and tissues are continuing to be oxygenated. But it's unfortunately happening for a dead body.
So it's so stark when you phrase it that way, but that's, in your judgment, the accurate way to say the sentence. So rather than my saying Jahi McMath is on a respirator, the more accurate sentence, in your view, would be the body of Jahi McMath is on that respirator.
That's correct. And I think you're getting to something that's really important, which is the words that we use, the language we use for describing these things are critically important. In some ways, the language of brain death is misleading itself because it makes it sound like it's kind of death or sort of death, but not really death. It's really that she died and was declared dead by virtue of neurological criteria. And instead of calling it brain death, we should simply say death. She sadly passed away.
David Greer, can you give us that definition from that standpoint? The definition of brain death is I'm just quoting now, irreversible cessation of all function of the brain, including the brain stem. But as David Magnus is just suggesting, in some ways that makes it sound like a type of death as opposed to death.
Well, I think he's entirely accurate. What we're dealing with is a definition, and this is a medical definition like any other medical determination that we have very strict criteria for saying when is the patient dead by neurological criteria. And he's absolutely right. There was the Uniform Determination of Death Act, which decided that according to the medical findings, that a patient can be dead either by the traditional cardiorespiratory definition or by brain criteria. And as you put it, it's the irreversible cessation of all brain function, including the brain stem. The key word is that it is irreversible. There is no chance that any of this could be recoverable, even the most rudimentary neurological functions, such as taking a breath. So that's where things stand, assuming that everything has been done correctly in this case, as it does sound that it has been.
So does that mean, and again, it's so difficult to frame this using these words, but does that mean that, in this case, Jahi McMath is not alive, but her body is? Is that right, David Greer?
That's correct. So she is legally dead at this point, and they are simply ventilating a body or a corpse, if you will, and putting oxygen through tissues. But the reason that this is a even an entity at all is that we created these artificial measures like ventilators many years ago that were to serve to try to save people. But now there are these entities where the body is, the organs are kept alive, if you will, but the patient is dead. And, of course, that was never what the intention of these machines was, to preserve just organs in this setting. So the patient is dead, and as was said by David Magnus, the patient has been dead for several days now.
Hmm. David Greer, professor of neurology at Yale School of Medicine. Chris Teich, director of bereavement services at Pathways Home Health and Hospice. You can't help but ache for this family. We've all seen them on the nightly news for these past weeks. And for the family, Jahi's heart is beating. And you can't help but understand their sort of fierce and desperate desire to hold on. So how do you contend with that?
You're absolutely right. I think the whole community is aching for this family. The loss of a child at any time is a tragedy. And I think it makes it particularly complicated and tragic that their loss is being broadcast for the whole community to see. And as they go through the normal process that anybody would go through with any loss, and particularly with the loss of a child, the incredible sense of wanting to deny and protest that this could even be so, and in particular in her case, where there was an unexpected loss. She was going in for what appeared to be a normal procedure, and they had reassured her that she would be fine, and to then discover that she died. They aren't really struggling with that concept, and I do think that is normal in the grief process. Most people, even in expected deaths, struggle with the reality that their loved one has died.
So if it's understandable, and of course it is, that a family would struggle, how do you measure time? I mean, people need time to come to terms with this, especially something tragic and unexpected, especially when it's your child. Mm-hmm. So how much time do you give? I mean, how much time?
Well, David and I were discussing this beforehand, and that's a very complicated question because everybody needs a different sense of time. But in this case, I'm not really qualified to determine how much time was needed. There's many variables with the hospital and other factors that needed to be considered that I'm not completely aware of. But families do need a certain amount of time to come to the reality that their loved one has died, and how the hospital and others help them move to that acceptance, at least for the beginning part and the beginning process of grief and loss, is a difficult and complicated one.
How do you respond to that, David Magnus, this question of time? Because it's hard to quantify, and yet in some ways, I suppose, in the end, you must. I mean, the court has quantified that by saying 5 o'clock today.
Well, how long it takes the family to cope and deal with the loss of their child is a different question from the question of whether or not the body should be kept on a ventilator. However long it takes the family to grieve, and it may be years before they can fully come to terms with this. And that's true for every family who has a tragic death of a child. And that's separate from the issue, though, of whether what we should be doing with the body in the interim. An ICU bed is a scarce medical resource. Pediatric ICU beds are even scarcer. Here in the Bay Area, we often don't have enough ICU beds to go around, and it often means delaying needed procedures. So we're talking about an incredibly high-tech environment that's used only in the most extreme circumstances to benefit patients and is an incredibly scarce resource. So how long do you utilize that resource, not for the benefit of a patient, because sadly, tragically, Jahai is gone. So how long do you utilize that resource, not for a patient, but for a family to give them time to grieve? And that's a tough one, but the right answer is clearly not very long.
But you know, David Magnus, I can imagine people listening right now who say, yeah, I get it. It's a precious resource, an ICU bed. But what if it's your child? You know, If this is the first person, not the third person, how then do you respond?
Well, again, I think we have to distinguish between situations where we would be using this resource to benefit a child or to keep a child alive, even if the prognosis is really poor. And this situation, there's nothing that the ventilators are doing that benefits Jahai. Nothing that's being done in that ICU right now is helping her at all. Hmm. She's gone. She's passed away. So these machines are not really doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is to help get patients through problems and to benefit them. So that makes it very different. What we need to do is focus on the family now and what it takes to get them to start to move through the grieving process. And it does seem to me that, and although I will accede to your superior knowledge about this, that allowing the legal system and the media to continue to facilitate that denial does not seem to me to be a healthy way for the family to start to move on.
What are we not understanding, David Greer, about, I guess, about death and about even what machines are capable of doing? We refer to these often. I started to write the sentence earlier this morning, life support. And then I said, well, is that really the right term? I mean, what do we need to understand right now that we're not?
Well, I think that term is correct, life support, because that's what these machines were intended for in patients who had a chance for life and for a good quality of life. They were not meant for death support, which is what is going on with this case, that the patient, in fact, is dead, and thus there's no point in carrying on with ventilation and artificial means to keep the organs and the body sustained during this time. I'm very careful not to say alive because, again, Jahai is not alive. The patient has died. So it's a matter of coming back to the core principle of what are these machines intended for, and does this patient apply for those rules? And in this case, that's absolutely not the case.
What do we need to understand right now to help families, Chris Tate, that we're not? What do you suggest in this circumstances that helps families contend with what they have to contend with and doesn't say you have forever to use this ICU bed, as David Magnus put it?
In this particular case, I think I'm not sure what happened or didn't happen, but it doesn't seem like they had the conversations with a medical team in a way that the families could begin to hear that she had died. I don't know, as David's inferred, that sometimes those conversations do not happen in the way they should. They're not clear with the family. They use euphemisms that confuse them. So I think that there is a deadline now, and the reality – I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry to jump in on you, but it sounds like the most useful sentence in some ways that needs to be said in the circumstances is not Jahai is experiencing brain death. It's to say Jahai died.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and to help the families come to that realization as much as they will have other issues that they're dealing with, because clearly they have some concerns around the medical team and what the practices were during her dying experience. But that is another journey. But to have her understood as having died would have been helpful.
There seems to be pretty clearly some breakdown of trust and understanding in this situation, David Magnus, between the family and the hospital. You're going to go do rounds this afternoon at Stanford Hospital. What do you do to make sure that doesn't come unglued in the way it clearly has here?
Yeah, that's a great question. When there's that breakdown in trust, it's really a huge problem for being able to have a therapeutic relationship continue and ongoing. I would say one thing that really is important is for physicians to get a lot more training than they get right now in how to communicate with patients and how and what sorts of words to use and how to communicate, especially around things that are very hard to say, because it's hard to tell families, "I'm afraid your loved one has died." It's very hard, and finding other ways of saying it that are obscure the facts is extremely common. All the empirical studies of end-of-life conversations that take place in the hospital, and we've done some ourselves. We've got some articles coming out on that in the next month. All of those studies show the same thing, which is communication is poor. Families don't spend a lot of time talking. Physicians talk at them. They often use very technical language when what they really need to be doing is talking in ways that families will understand. In occasions when families bring up issues or open the door to further conversations, physicians tend to block those conversations and steer things towards technical issues that they feel more comfortable with. I have absolutely no idea about what happened in this particular case or what kinds of conversations took place, since we don't have access to any of that information. But across the board, we do know that communication between physicians and families around these very difficult issues is not very good, and we know that physicians are not very much trained. Very little effort is made to train them to have those conversations.
David Greer, do you concur with that in your work? There was a really fine documentary done here in the Bay Area last year called The Waiting Room that showed the day in the life of an ER in Oakland. And I remember one scene of it in particular where a more senior physician said to a resident who was going to have to tell a family that their loved one had died. And the advice was, you've got to say these words and you've got to be blunt about it. Don't pull any punches. Is that part of what needs to happen? Is that true in your experience, as David Magnus is suggesting, that physicians need some work here or some training here to say what needs to be said?
You know, it's absolutely true. We don't do a great job of educating people in general about how to have these family discussions, although there is a big effort being made to do so. You obviously need to be compassionate, and you need to be understanding, and you need to be patient, but you do need to be blunt, and you need to be straightforward, so there is no ambiguity. And as you're saying those words, that your loved one is dead, you also say, "I am so sorry, this must be awfully hard for you, and I wish there was something else that we could do, but the fact is, she is dead." And you do have to say those words. If you beat around the bush, all you do is leave the door open. The other things to do in a situation like this is, it's not just a physician walking in and talking to the family. It should be a group approach where you're working with nursing and you're working with social work and you're working with religious ministries as well, preferably with the religion of the patient and family, so that it is a group approach and the family doesn't feel that there's a one-sided dictator coming in saying this is the way it is, and then it's done. It needs to be done compassionately, but also in a very straightforward manner.
It sounds like, Chris Tate, that part of what's really key here is that that approach that David Greer is describing, that it needs to involve someone who the family trusts, and you need, if you're in your business, in all of your businesses, an ally, really, right?
Exactly. I can tell you, when I was a social worker out in the field, going into families who had been signed on to hospice from their physicians, how many of them, when I began to talk about the dying process and what to expect and supporting them in preparing for it, acted as though it was the first time they were hearing it. Now, they may have, in fact, heard it from the doctor and weren't able to hear it in that moment, but I tend to wonder whether or not they were told in language clear enough that they were being signed on to hospice because they were facing a terminal illness and their death was imminent.
So I want to ask about the second sentence that you say, David Magnus, in this kind of situation. If the first sentence is, "I'm sorry to tell you, but your loved one has died," now there's a second question or a second sentence, which is, "But right now, she is being kept alive by a breathing machine. Or right now, she's still able to her heart is still beating because she's on this machine. It seems to me that second sentence is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you don't say that in the right way, and I have witnessed that, where people say things that in a way undermine the first sentence. If you say it the way you just mentioned, I'm afraid she's passed away, but she's still alive on a breathing tube, well, then in what sense is she dead? And that does raise the fact that brain death is confusing to people. And the language makes it confusing. It makes it seem like it's not real death, and it is confusing. So I think using the right words is really important. Saying the patient has passed away and then making it clear that right now what's happening is that the ventilator support is continuing to oxygenate the patient's organs, but she is gone and she's passed away. So you have to be very, very careful about what's said, and then really focus really at that point, because the patient's passed away, on the family is a shift. What you really need to be saying is, I wish there was more that we could do, and start to move towards what mm-hmm. they need to do to deal with over the loss that they're suffering, rather than this the anything that implies that the patient isn't dead.
So we shouldn't say brain death any more than we would say heart death?
Correct. If you look at the policies and the criteria, they're exactly parallel. We don't typically say, I'm afraid your loved one has suffered circulatory or cardiac death. We just say they died. And it's the same thing here. Yeah. We should just say, I'm very sorry, but they've passed away. They've died. That's the reality. It's slightly different criteria that are used, but the outcome is the same.
Do you agree with that, David Greer? Do you need to change the way in which that sentence is said?
Well, I agree with the finality that it is death, but I think that people have gotten to that point understanding that their loved one has suffered some kind of neurological catastrophe. So that's how I approach these, is saying that the catastrophe was so severe that the patient has lost all brain function, and thus they are what we call brain dead, or dead by neurological criteria, and brain death equals death, that the patient is now legally dead. Because it shouldn't be a surprise to the family that the reason that they've died is because of the brain. So I do think that you do need to incorporate that somewhere in the language so that they understand what criteria that you've used. Because if they're still looking at the patient and the monitor, seeing that the heart is beating and that there's an oxygen level, they may have trouble unless you explain to them clearly how you came to that conclusion.
Can I ask maybe what's a naive question, but why is that, if someone has died, why is that respirator then still hooked up?
So you're asking me again,
yeah,
David Greer?
Yeah.
So the respirator is hooked up for a couple of reasons. One is that you need to be able to tell the family that there's this finality. And number two, that on the other end of this, sometimes there's an opportunity for organ donation.
Oh, right.
Those two are decoupled, of course, that the brain death diagnosis is made completely independently from any move towards a discussion of organ donation. However, there is the stark reality that many of these patients can potentially donate life-saving organs to other people. And so that's another discussion that can take place with the proper personnel.
David Greer, professor of neurology and neurosurgery at Yale School of Medicine, joining us along with Chris Teich, director of bereavement services at Pathways, and David Magnus, director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'd like your calls, your thoughts, your participation in this conversation about how we understand death and how we come to terms with it. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts on our website or on our Facebook page. I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. Our topic this hour, the story of Jahi McMath and what that tells us, perhaps teaches us, about how we contend with death in our society and what can best be done for families who are facing that tragic circumstance. You can join our conversation at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts on our Facebook page or website. lots of people calling in who want to join into our conversation, and I will get to those calls in one moment. But I want to bring up one question first, David Magnus, which a lot of people sort of go back in time and remember the Terri Schiavo case from a number of years ago and the great family and legal drama that played out surrounding that. This is different, though, and I think we probably all need to be reminded of what persistent vegetative state, another one of those sort of odd, somewhat euphemistic kind of phrases, means compared to this particular circumstance.
Yeah. So a persistent vegetative state or a permanent vegetative state, those are all actually very well-defined neurological states, but the cases are dramatically different. Terri Schiavo was alive. She had a horrible prognosis because really all she had was her brainstem and hence had wake and sleep cycles. But it's really important for people to understand that there's a difference between being comatose or unconscious, being vegetative, which is not being unconscious. You might have wake and sleep cycles, but you're not able to interact meaningfully with the world. Those are all living patients with really horrifically awful prognoses. And then there's a debate about who decides under those circumstances what should be done for those patients. That's fundamentally different from this case, which is really about a patient who's passed away. This isn't a patient with a bad prognosis. This isn't a patient who's highly unlikely or maybe certainly never to recover. This is about someone who died. And what the family is hoping for as a miracle is not an improvement and beating the medical odds. What they're hoping for is resurrection.
And David Greer, that means then, again, the importance of precision of language and making sure – because in one case, you know, there are choices and the question of time and coming to terms with one prognosis is different than coming to terms with a death that has happened.
That's correct. And the definition of a persistent vegetative state is exactly right. That patient is alive. They are able to actually sustain their own respirations and rudimentary brain function, and they don't require a ventilator. And they even can be awake and have their eyes open, but there's no interaction with the environment. So the definitions are very clear. They're very straightforward. The terms, unfortunately, can be confusing for people if you don't take the time to explain exactly what things mean.
Yeah. Let's take some of our calls. Phil wants to start us out on that question. Phil, go ahead, please.
Hi. First off, condolences to the family. You know, this must be very hard for them. Most of the conversation has been about how the medical community may not be telling the family what's been going on, but there's no way that they can't know because all these courts are involved and they're trying to get their child into a care facility. So, you know, I think the issue here is really, you know, to what extent does a family have a runway to deal with their grief? And the other thing is if you could explain how this, you know, how the determination of the child's death was made. Is it through a CAT scan or, you know, let us know what the family has been told.
Yeah, Phil, thanks for the call. Don't know as we know exactly what was communicated to the family. Do we, other than these determinations have been made by, I think you said, six different physicians, David Magnus?
Yeah, at this point, there have been six different examinations that have all found the patient is dead by neurological criteria.
And Chris Tate, on Phil's other question about how much room do you give families? I mean, that's such a difficult question. But how do you start that process or even expedite that process if you need to?
Well, to the point, it doesn't necessarily serve the family to allow them to have a long period of time where their daughter has died and that is still being held as a question that is no longer, in fact, a question. She has died. To help the family begin their grieving process by accepting that reality is the best way to start moving them forward. It is a long journey through the loss of a child, through any loss, but through the loss of a child in particular. The family needs as much time as they can, but this has sidetracked them. And if the focus is too much on the fact that a miracle could happen, I think it doesn't serve the family in their grief process. It actually complicates it.
Phil, thanks. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Eleanor in Oakland. Eleanor, go ahead, please.
Yes, I totally agree with what the grief counselor has just said and pretty much all of the commentary this morning. And thank you for having this very important and difficult discussion. I also send condolences to this family. Our family went through this in 1992 when my daughter Maya fell from a horse, went into a profound coma, and was declared brain dead at John Muir Hospital. So I understand the profound shock that this family is experiencing. Fortunately for our family, we were spoken to in a very blunt way. At the time, I thought it was too blunt, but in retrospect, I'm very grateful because we were given no choice. There was no choice about whether she was going to be taken off the ventilator. The doctor clearly communicated that she was dead, that he was signing a death certificate, that he had called in a second physician to verify the process. I was aware that studies were being done in nuclear medicine where dye was being pumped through her veins, and it was shown that there was absolutely no brain flow to her brain, blood flow to her brain. So it was made extremely clear to me. And while it was shocking and horrible, and walking away from my daughter's bed for the final time was the most difficult thing I hope I ever have to do in my life, at least it was clear. My minister immediately came to the hospital. I had family support. I had, in retrospect, it's odd to say you're fortunate, but I was fortunate, and I was given the option of organ donation, which I decided to do. Mm-hmm. So my daughter became an organ and tissue donor, which adds a different level to this. In some ways it helps the grief, in some ways it complicates it. However, something good came out of a terrible tragedy, and I subsequently met the man who received her heart, his family. I'm still in touch with his daughter. I've met the woman who received my daughter's liver. It brought about, over the course of the last 21 years, some amazing results. And so while this is a terrible, terrible tragedy for the family, I agree with what Chris Tetch is saying, that what they need now to help facilitate their grieving process is a group of people to clearly say that, unfortunately, their daughter is dead, and they need to let go, do whatever rituals they need to do at her bedside, and then walk away and allow her body to be prepared for burial.
Eleanor, thank you. Thank you for telling us your story, and it means a lot, I think, to everyone listening to hear the way in which you have contended with this and the good that you have been able to see in the last 20 years from the decisions that you made. Eleanor, thank you. David Magnus, she so eloquently described this other aspect of this, and yet there can be sometimes a concern when someone is dead but their organs are available for transplantation, that there's too much focus on that, and that somehow is depriving the family of coming to terms with that death. How do you balance the need and the desire for organ transplantation versus what the family must also face?
So there's a very sharp line that's actually drawn so that the teams taking care of the patient have absolutely nothing to do with the organ procurement process. So the consenting for the organs and dealing with all of those happen after the patient's already been declared to have passed away, and after the information has been given to the family, and it's actually handled by somebody outside of the hospital. It's done by the organ procurement organization here in the Bay Area. That's the California Transplant Donor Network. So it's actually a completely separate group that's actually involved in doing that. So we have a very strong firewall to prevent any kind of conflicts of interest or any kind of problems.
So you're not in a situation where the same person is saying your child has died, and by the way, we'd like to make sure that person's organs are now available. It's different.
Correct. So the people who are taking care of the patient, and the patient has now tragically passed away, that's communicated to the family. Then people from the donor network come in and talk to the family about whether or not this is an option for them. And as the caller indicated, for many, many families, being able to donate their organs is a way of finding some silver lining in a horribly tragic circumstance. But can I just add one other thing that's really important? People who are questioning whether or not neurological criteria should count as dead, which is really what the lawyer representing the McMath family is claiming, have to understand that if that were to happen, if we were to give up the notion that brain dead patients are dead, that would also mean the end of virtually all cadaveric organ procurement. So the consequences for making these kinds of decisions are not just that we would lose ICU beds, but we would also lose almost all organ procurement.
Michelle writes on her Facebook page, I have a question. When the patient dies while on life support, why is there a question or an opportunity for the patient's family to argue whether or not to continue that support? David Greer?
Well, there really shouldn't be that opportunity if things are done correctly, that it is final. There are times that I've encountered families that are unaccepting of this. And rather than pressuring them and saying, we're not listening to you, you try to be understanding and try to help them toward a better understanding of what's going on. And I will often get in a second clinician who's been involved in the determination and also get in our local ethics committee to help them understand that this is, in fact, the case that the patient is dead, so that they've heard it from multiple standpoints. We also may get our chief medical officer of the hospital involved if need be, because it ultimately will come down to his say that the patient will be or the body will be removed from the ventilator. There are certain states that have stipulations regarding some exceptions for certain patients who have religious objections, which have been very clearly delineated, but I don't know that California has such an exception or rule.
California has no exception for the brain death determination. We do have a law that says that families need to be given a time after the declaration of brain death to be able to come and visit the family and carry out any religious rituals, but that's for the family, not for the patient.
Diane writes in, we should emphasize that Children's Hospital is not a novice at treating children, and because they treat the sickest of children, they've had this conversation with parents over the last century more than once. The conversation participants include professionally trained social workers, spiritual leaders, and others, much like your speakers, and that's taken place over weeks. And Michelle writes in, you shouldn't be discussing this family situation without the family, their representatives, or their minister. It's patronizing. I don't know the right answers, but I do know this approach is wrong. It's an interesting point. I mean, we consciously decided that we wanted to do this program to have a broader discussion, to use the story of Jahi McMath and its tragic consequences to trigger this larger conversation. But what do you think about that? And let me ask you, is it inappropriate to have this kind of conversation without involving the family? There's been so much media attention about this story, David Magnus. I wonder how you assess what's right to talk about over the media and what isn't.
Well, obviously, it's never a good thing when you have medical issues and cases, and actual ongoing cases, turning into large media stories and being acted out in the courts. Almost every court decision starts with saying something to the effect that it's unfortunate that we're involved at all. But given that it has become that kind of a story, it creates an opportunity, I think, to try and present some clarity, because these notions of death, the language used, the concepts are very, very confusing. And watching the discussion and the media coverage makes it very clear that people do not understand what brain death means and what the status is medically and legally of the patient. And that does need to be clarified for people.
Tony in Pinole joins us next. Tony, go ahead, please.
Yeah, in this entire discussion that we're having about Jahi, which is tragic, of course, I've not heard any mention of multicultural aspects on how people view death. For example, my main question was, out of the six physicians who made a determination that she was brain dead, were there any physicians there that were trained in, say, for example, traditional Chinese medicine, or of any other viewpoint of death, such as Native American viewpoint of death, African American viewpoint of death, et cetera? Thank you.
Yeah, Tony, it's an interesting and important question. Chris Tate, maybe you can involve your perspective on this, because there's often a lot that needs to be communicated and needs to be understood when you are in an environment where people's own cultural attitudes are different.
And in fact, that often plays a part in talking with families as they're experiencing the death of a loved one. Most important for me as a grief counselor is to understand what their perspective is on death and dying. That's very helpful for me to hear from them how they perceive what happens in the dying process, what happens to their loved ones when they die, so that I can support them in whatever their needs are at that time. In this particular case, I don't know that the physicians knowing particular cultural differentiating variables would help, but I am convinced that it would be helpful in the grief journey to have some cultural support.
Well, let's say in a circumstance, you're in a circumstance where someone says, my child's heart is still beating. I believe that she's alive. In my cultural perspective and approach, that's the case. And in my religious belief, I believe in the possibility of miracles. What do you say then?
I would have to give that to the ethicist here to speak to, because my situation is often dealing with people after the loved one has already died.
David?
So that is a challenge with getting people to understand what it means for them to have passed away and the fact that there are some of those differences. Back east, where there are larger groups of Orthodox Jews, and many Orthodox Jews do not accept the concept of brain death. And so there are a couple of states, New York, New Jersey, that do have very tightly defined religious exceptions to the brain death criteria, so that a patient would legally be alive under those states under certain circumstances, in cases that they wouldn't in most states. What we can say is that the medical community as a whole, and especially the neurological community, has come to an agreement about what it means to be dead. And the states and the federal level as well have come to an agreement that is what it means to be dead. The fact does remain that there can always be individuals who don't agree with that determination. And that same issue arises whether it's death by neurological criteria or by cessation of circulation. And in fact, at the present time, there's less clarity around that than there is around brain death in terms of definition. And there's a lot of questions around pushing the envelope about how long after cessation of the heart do you count as a patient having passed away. The answer really is, here in California, we have decided that the mainstream neurological criteria is both the medical definition of death and the legal definition of death. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a philosophical concept of death as well, which has to do with when the person is gone. That, interestingly, is on the other side, which is even when the patient is still alive legally and neurologically, the person that they were can still be lost. Terri Schiavo was still alive in the legal and neurological sense, but everything about who she was, her memories, her personality was lost. And it's actually why, if you look at surveys, a majority of physicians and even neurologists really believe that the patients have died when they're not legally dead, but when all of that is lost.
Gets grayer and grayer and more complex in some ways the deeper you mine this topic. I want to turn to a question that's come in that David Greer, perhaps you can comment on, who writes, my teenage niece had the same procedure that Jai had done, which was a tonsil and adenoid procedure for sleep apnea. She was fine. So what went wrong here? Has there been a proper independent investigation about the whether or not medical mistakes were made? And I guess we have a number of other listeners who have written in about this as well, David Greer. And this sort of complicates this further, because if there's a sense that something went wrong that shouldn't have, then you, I would think, are less likely to accept the outcome. How do you contend with that?
Well, I think it's an interesting point. However, when I get called in as a neurologist, it's really for the specific question regarding brain death or neurological prognosis, however the patient got there, whether it was by natural means or unnatural means. It seems very clear, although I don't know the details of this case, that something obviously went wrong. This was a routine planned surgery that ended up with the patient becoming brain dead. So does that enter the thinking of people involved in the case? Certainly. Certainly would involve a change in thinking for the family, and they're probably very angry regarding that aspect of the care. But again, I don't know the details of that. Does it enter into the physician's thinking? Well, hopefully the physicians that have been brought in, particularly the neurologists or neurosurgeons who have been involved in the determination of brain death, that should not be involved in their thinking whatsoever. Again, brain death is a medical and legal diagnosis of death, and it should be entirely separate from whatever it was that caused it, as long as it's known to be a neurological catastrophe that's irreversible, causing complete cessation of all brain function.
Is that something that's important, Christage, to keep separate what goes on there so that you the best you can, understandable as it is, that the anger over what may have happened, in the end, it doesn't change the fact?
Exactly. I wanted to go back to what the caller said. I think it is indeed clear from what both callers said that the community of support that they receive is essential in not only their understanding and coming to terms with the death, but going through the grief journey. And whatever their culture and their community of support, that is an essential part as they go on this very long journey. This is just the beginning piece of starting to begin to recognize that the person has in fact died, and they are struggling with this and protesting this loudly. And it's not unfamiliar to many grieving families as they go through the process of learning to accept that their loved one has died. So it's not surprising at all. It's just that it's in such a public forum that I do feel for this family that they have had their grief and loss experience put to the public.
Rebecca in Santa Rosa is our next caller. Rebecca.
I'm a mother who went through a similar situation about 10 years ago. And something that nobody else has brought out is the pressure that you get from the attorneys telling you that you can, they come out of nowhere, you can get a lot of money by suing. And all of a sudden you're in front of the press and you go from being a nobody to a star. And it's not just dealing with the death, it's dealing with the press and lawyers, which I personally consider unscrupulously trying to get into somebody's pocket.
Rebecca, thanks. David?
Yeah, it's I completely agree that these kinds of issues really do not belong in court. The determination of death is a medical determination. It's done by physicians in accordance with very well and clearly defined law that's been established for many decades. This is not a cutting-edge area of law. This is something that's been well established for decades. It's hard to see why the courts would get involved at all. And almost any time the courts do get involved, it's usually bad news. They don't want to be there. Courts don't want to play the role of deciding when ventilators get shut off or when somebody has passed away. That's really something that doctors should do. So I completely agree. Once you have lawyers involved, they've got their own agendas and their own set of interests, which have nothing at all to do with Jahai and what's best for her.
Though I should note in fairness, at least as I've understood it in the press accounts of this story, the attorney who is representing the family is taking this case on a pro bono basis. So we should note that. A comment from Alex who writes, this is a tragic story and there may or may not have been medical malpractice. We have no way of knowing. But it's also tragic that we are wasting precious resources to care for what is now clearly a dead body. Religious faith is fine as a source of personal strength and comfort, but it shouldn't be the basis for making medical decisions. Just have a few minutes left, and I want to ask each of you what you think we should take from this sad story. 6 hours from now, unless something changes, that breathing machine will be disconnected. But the story, the concerns, the journey, as Christage has put it, goes on. What should we be talking about, I guess, trying to come to terms with better in this arena? David Greer?
I think it comes down to the need for effective communication, and that was raised several times during this past hour. But without effective communication with the family, every step of the way, not just at the time when you're talking about brain death, but definitely before then, so that they understand what's going on, what does prognosis mean, what are the different possibilities, so that when you do have that ultimate conversation, it's not a surprise, and the family has been able to ease toward an understanding of what's happening with their loved one.
And Chris Tate.
I think a lot can be learned by understanding that this is a tremendous loss that families face, and that we need to take the opportunity to help support them in facing that the death is a reality. And now, how do we support them through the grief process?
David Magnus.
I agree with what Dr. Greer said, that the way in which this is communicated to families, being very clear and not just by the physicians but also the media communication to the public, that we be very clear about what these words mean and what's really happening. Everybody's hearts go out to this family. It's a tragic – anytime a child dies, it's a tragedy. When it's unexpected, it's even more so. But the tragedy has happened, and what we need to do is to help the family move on from that tragedy rather than perpetuate misunderstandings.
With that, we'll bring our conversation to a close. I want to thank all of our guests for being part of this important, I think, conversation, and the need for that conversation, of course, will continue on into the future. David Greer, professor of neurology and neurosurgery at Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Greer, thanks for being part of our discussion today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Chris Tate joins us as well, director of bereavement services for Pathways Home Health and Hospice. Chris, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And David Magnus, director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics, the Thomas A. Raffin Professor of Medicine and Biomedical Ethics, also a professor of pediatrics at Stanford University. David, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lorberg. Our engineer today is Jim Bennett. Amanda Supai is our engagement producer. And Dan Zoll is our senior editor. I'm Dave Iverson in for Michael Krasny. Judy Campbell will be the guest host on Forum tomorrow, and then on New Year's Day, we'll bring you some programs from our archives, including interviews of Michael's with Malcolm Gladwell and other authors. That's coming up on Forum over the next couple of days. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.